Hello and welcome to the programme. You can visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. So, a lovely show ahead of us tonight. Can you hear that sound in the background, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls? You're not imagining it. Does it sound like an owl to you? But what kind of owl is it? Niall Hatch is in studio. We'll be joined by Terry Flanagan shortly, Richard Collins and Aineen Lowney. But let's start with you, Niall. What is it?
Well, you're right. It is an owl, Derek, and it's our most numerous owl species of the three that occur regularly here in Ireland. It's the long-eared owl, a species that, although it's relatively numerous, it's not often seen. They're nocturnal. They keep a low profile, and it's always a treat to hear one make that sound. So delighted to hear it now. It brings back lots of memories.
Absolutely gorgeous.
Magical. Transports you. It's a very hollow, kind of resonant sound. It does carry quite a distance, particularly on a still evening. And, you know, we often think of owls as hooting. And the famous hooting owl is the tawny owl, which we don't have in Ireland, the one that goes twit, twoo. So this is the closest that we have. And that certainly could be described as a hooting in a way. It's certainly that low, resonant sound that carries across. They also make some other sounds, long-eared owls. One of the most common sounds you hear from them is an alarm call they give. It sounds a bit like a barking dog, like a dog barking in the distance. It's surprisingly yappy and abrupt. And then the call that I probably hear most often of that species is in sort of late July, early August, that time of year when the young have just left the nest. They make a very distinctive sound when they're begging their parents for food. It sounds like a squeaky gate, like swinging on rusty hinges, this sort of squeaking, drawn out sound. And a lot of people contact us in Birdwatch Ireland and contact us here at Mooney Goes Wild asking, what's that sound? And yeah, it's young long-eared owls begging their parents for food.
But you're a curious kind of guy, aren't you, Noel? You're interested in stuff.
I'm curious, yes.
You didn't ask me why I'm playing that sound.
Why are you playing that sound, Eric?
Thank you very much indeed. Well, I just happened to find a copy of Wings, your members' magazine from Birdwatch Ireland, on my desk. And I was leafing through it and I came across the most wonderful photographs of long-eared owl chicks. And it says, growing by the week, taken by photographer Fiona Keane. And it says, I first started taking photos during the COVID pandemic in 2020. I've always loved birds and nature, and my local park seemed like a good place to start my wildlife photography journey. Well, I can tell you, Fiona, the photographs are absolutely first class. But this is your summer issue. So when is the next issue due out now?
The next issue is due out in October. I'm hard at work on it at the moment. Wings at the moment, it comes out three times a year. It's Birdwatch Ireland's membership magazine. And that photo feature that you mentioned, we always have a feature in the centre pages. It's either a photographer or an artist and their work. And the owl one we've just had that Fiona's wonderful photographs are featured in, that has got a great response. People love owls in Ireland and all over the world, I think. Owls are very, very popular birds. There's a certain magic and mystery to them, I think. Although, looking at Fiona's pictures, you'd think that they have no fear of anybody. They're out in broad daylight in most of these photographs, and that's what the youngsters do. It's the best time of year to see them.
Well, she's got one terrific photograph. It's one of the young owls at 10 weeks of age, and it says, ready to strike out on its own, and it's staring right down the lens. And you can see clearly that disc-shaped face.
Yes.
Those wonderful orange eyes and the black pupil staring right out at you.
It's appropriate you should mention the eyes, Derek, because you can tell the difference between Ireland's three owl species through their eye colour. Mm. So the long-eared owl, as these photographs show, they have orange eyes with obviously a black pupil in the middle. The short-eared owl, which is closely related to this, has yellow eyes. And then the barn owl, probably our most famous owl, the late show owl, that has all dark eyes. So that's how you can tell the difference between them. But although the barn owl gets a lot of attention and it's probably the most famous, and it's doing better, actually. The numbers are increasing. My colleagues, John Lusby and Alan McCarthy, have done a lot of work there. There's a lot of men's sheds groups and tidy towns groups across the country, local authorities helping that species. It's nowhere near as numerous or as common or as widespread as the long-eared owl. It's certainly our most numerous.
But now, if I'm not mistaken, the original opening animation for the Late Late Show featured a long-eared owl, not a barn owl.
Yes, it seems to have changed over the years. Certainly the barn owl is the one that's most associated with it now. And so that's often a lot of people's introduction to it. But all three owls that we have in Ireland, they they're all very similar in size. They actually look bulkier than they are because they have such fluffy, dense feathers. The little skeleton and body under that feather is a lot smaller than you'd actually think.
They're very light, aren't they?
Very lightweight indeed. And they're the perfect hunting machines. That facial disc that you mentioned on the owl's face, that really acts a bit like a satellite dish to gather in the sound waves and direct them towards the bird's ears.
You can see clearly the two tufts, which look like ears, on the top of the owl's head. Now, what is the purpose of having those when they're not ears at all?
That's right. So the long-eared owl is named after those long tufts on top of the head, which they can raise and lower at will, so they don't always show them. And it was originally thought that these were ears. They look a bit like the ears of a bat. They're not ears at all. They have no hearing function. They are for signalling emotion and giving communication. So when an owl is startled or surprised or maybe feeling aggressive, it raises those ear tufts. If it's showing it's more docile to one of its fellows, it lowers those tufts. So you can tell a lot about the state of the bird's mind at that stage by looking at the ear tufts. The ears themselves, that do hear very well, they're on the sides of the head, just behind that facial disc. And very unusually for an animal, one ear is slightly higher in the skull than the other. And that's an adaptation that allows them to pinpoint exactly where their prey is, because they can hunt in pretty much total darkness by listening for their prey. In this case, it's usually mice, small rodents, things like that. They can hear the little rustling they make on the ground. Mm. And they're so good at hearing because of that facial disc, they can pinpoint exactly where it is. And what happens, because their ears are asymmetrical, the sound wave hits one ear slightly microseconds before it hits the other ear, and that's enough for that bird to be able to triangulate and pinpoint exactly where the prey is and swoop down and get it.
You've also got a lovely article celebrating women and conservation, and then on page 23 at the bottom right hand corner you're saying to your reader, in recent months the Birdwatch Ireland team has been working on our 2024-2030 organisational strategy with the support of BirdLife International and RSPB. We are delighted to announce that it is now at the final draft stage, and you've got a barcode and people can scan that. So what do you want your readers to do?
It's Birdwatch Ireland's action plan up until 2030. It's what we want to do. It's saying all the different areas we're going to work in, what the priorities for the organisation are. As a charity, as an NGO with limited funding and a desire to increase that funding, we do what we can. We have to cut our cloth to fit our measure, but we're very ambitious. And I certainly would urge people to go to our website, birdwatchireland.ie. You'll find a whole list of publications there, including the finalised strategy. Please have a look at it and send us comments on it. See what you think of it. And if you think that the work we're doing deserves your support, please do join as members. Then you receive the Wings magazine in the post that we're talking about.
Can you put a link on our website?
I will absolutely do that with pleasure.
You're doing the notes. And then you haven't forgotten the younger reader. You've got Bird Detectives, and it's for the younger members of Birdwatch.
That's right.
Lots of stuff in there. What I like, but I looked through this one, was nest identification.
Yes.
So nest knowledge, where birds find a safe place to raise their young. And you've got lots of photographs, how they choose to nest and where, which is wonderful.
Bird Detectives magazine, it's one of my favourite things to work on in Birdwatch Ireland. It's all introduced by our head bird detective, who's Shelduck Holmes, who appears there. And he brings our younger readers and their families on an exploration and a journey of Irish wildlife in each issue. And I particularly like that nest knowledge feature that you have there. My colleague Amy Lewis, our communications officer, wrote that and is an invaluable help with the magazine. She's wonderful, along with Michael O'Cleary, who is the designer of this, and Wings magazine. I work with Colleen McLaughlin on that, who's been on the programme several times before. And it's great, because with Bird Detectives magazine, it's very much aimed at helping young people in Ireland to explore nature, to get their hands dirty, to contribute to surveys. It's all specifically to do with Irish wildlife. You know, over the years I've spoken to thousands and thousands of school children in schools up and down the country. You'll always meet children in every class who are incredibly interested in wildlife, very well informed, but I guarantee you they'll tend to know more about the wildlife of sub-Saharan Africa or the Amazon rainforest or Antarctica than they will about the wildlife of their own back garden or their own schoolyard. And that's a pity, because the wildlife around us is every bit as fascinating when you look at it in the right way, but it's also much more relevant to our everyday lives. That's what Bird Detectives is all about. It's about exploring nature on your doorstep and encouraging people not just to observe it passively, but to take action to protect it and to submit data as citizen scientists to then inform us about their conservation. So it's starting children from a very young age, habituating them to contributing and showing that they can play a role in saving nature. I think it's really important.
Now, the RSPB.
Yes.
They speak out for birds and wildlife.
They do.
And you do at Birdwatch Ireland too. But I know they've got over 1 million members and something in the region of 170,000 youth members.
Yes.
Have you got that many?
We don't, and I think that pretty much no other conservation organisation in the world does. The RSPB, the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds, is a bird protection partner that we have in the UK. So they operate in Northern Ireland.
And they're the largest wildlife conservation organisation in Europe.
They are. They're absolutely massive. So I think it's about 1.1 million members. They're one of the largest landowners in Britain. It's amazing how large they are. They've been around since 1890. There's obviously a much larger population in the UK than there is in Ireland. But also, there's been more of, I suppose, support for conservation going way, way back to Victorian times in Britain. It's really a much more recent phenomenon in Ireland, but also in many other European countries as well. I think that sometimes within Ireland, we can often compare ourselves too much with the UK as though it's an analogy for us. And certainly within the BirdLife International family, because we're all members of an international umbrella group called BirdLife International, I think that sometimes the UK isn't the best comparison. Okay, they're English speaking, of course, so at least predominantly so. So it's a sort of natural to compare ourselves. But I think Ireland actually is much better if we compare ourselves with like the Scandinavian countries or some of the Mediterranean countries. Compare us to places like Portugal or Denmark, and actually we punch quite a bit above our weight in terms of membership, in terms of resources here in BirdWatch Ireland. But the great thing about the BirdLife International family is you actually have 120 national partners around the world, all collaborating, all sharing information and resources and know-how. And that makes it a big force to be reckoned with. And I think it's bordering now on 3 million members worldwide, including our BirdWatch Ireland members, which we're very proud of. We have 15,000 members across the country, but we could always do with more. So if you're listening to this and you want to support us and you want to support birds and make sure they're there for future generations and learn about birds and have fun while you're doing it and take part in our branch activities all over Ireland, you'll find full details at birdwatchireland.ie.
Great stuff, Niall. Thank you very much indeed. Now, you're going to be interested in this next segment. Our reporter, Terry Flanagan, is now a news anchorman, if you like, because each week on our website, rte.ie/Mooney, he will be writing up Terry's Nature News. So we've had to dig out a piece of music. Have we got it ready? We have indeed. So it's time now for the Nature News with Mr. Terence Flanagan. I'm sure the RTE newsroom won't mind on this one occasion. Anyway, Terry Flanagan has some nature news for us, as I've just said. And we start, Terry, with good news for corncrakes.
Well, listen, it's nice to be able to start with a good news story and an Irish one. And it's good news for corncrakes because we know over the years we've had terrible problems with our corncrake numbers. And the numbers, Niall, I'm sure you'll confirm for me, were down at one stage around 100 nesting pairs per year in the country. And various initiatives had been undertaken to try and improve these numbers. And one of those initiatives I remember many years ago was the idea of farmers when they were cutting their hay that they would cut from the inside of the field out rather than from the outside of the field in. And I do believe that did have some success. Well, however, since 2021, a five-year project has been undertaken by the National Parks and Wildlife Service, and it seems as if this has been quite successful.
It certainly is great to see positive news about corncrakes for a change, because it's a species that we've tracked the fortunes of since the very beginning of this programme, and it's been a very sad tale. We're talking about a species that declined from maybe a peak of 50,000 pairs to, as you said, scarcely 100 in the recent past there, Terry. So to see any upward movement in their numbers is really, really positive. So hats off to everyone in the National Parks and Wildlife Service, to all of the farmers and landowners who've been participating in this, to my colleagues in BirdWatch Ireland and other conservation groups too who've been playing a role. It's good to see the tide turning. I think, you know, to put it in context, the numbers are still really, really low.
Yeah, I was going to say that they are still quite low, aren't they?
And let's be realistic about it. They're never going to be back the way they were because that habitat no longer exists. But I don't be pessimistic about it. The fact is, if we're able to maintain this as an Irish breeding species, prevent it from going extinct, and to at least allow that species to have that genetic reservoir there to spread, and also spreading to new areas of trying to Kerry now to breed, for example, in new sites where it hadn't been for a couple of generations. So that is really is positive, and onwards and upwards with the work. I know there's some captive breeding work being done with corncrakes as well, which may bear fruit and may help to boost the numbers in the wild, boost that genetic diversity. So I would have thought that by now in Ireland, corncrake may well have gone extinct, and it hasn't. So I'm really delighted about that.
Well, isn't it great that they're
off to everybody at the Corncrake Life Project? Yeah.
Yeah, isn't it great to see that they're back in counties like Kerry, where they've never been before? Well, not certainly for many, many years. And I believe there were 233 corncrake territories recorded in Ireland this year. And that's an increase of 45% since 2018. So I just think these grants, they we still, these grants and these schemes, we'll still need to use them as an incentive to try and increase them even further.
I think, you know, the farmers and landowners who are allowing room for these corn crakes and managing their farms in a corn crake friendly way, it's got to be recognised that they're in many cases taking a financial hit for doing that. So it's only right that they're compensated. They're farming for biodiversity. They're helping us to meet our international targets. So that's something that as taxpayers and as citizens here in Ireland who benefit from our environment and all the advantages it brings to us, it's something that's worth paying for. I think that's really important.
Richard.
Yes, I believe they're back on the Aran Islands, or rather, they were heard calling on the Aran Islands. This is a great change. I've been to the Aran Islands very often, and I never heard corncrakes there. The last ones I heard were in Ireland, were on Inishbofin. It's great to see them coming back. It reminds me of how things used to be back in the 40s and 50s, where you heard the corncrake everywhere. And you heard them in quite built-up areas even, so there's hope for us.
Yes, it's a species that can tolerate humans very well. I mean, it's a species that was once abundant all over Ireland. Even if people had large overgrown gardens, you would find them there. And I've seen them in similar habitat like that still in Eastern Europe. It's more the intensification of agriculture and the silage production, the cutting of meadows multiple times during the summer before the chicks could hatch. That cause a lot of problems for them. And we've also seen other things like former strongholds like the Shannon Callows subjected to summer flooding now. Climate change is rearing its ugly head again. And because corncrakes are ground nesting birds, if the waters rise and they flood, well, the eggs or the chicks then get washed away or chill. And corncrakes are very short-lived birds. They only live for about 2 years. So if you have two bad breeding seasons...
Very
short-lived. Remarkable. So you get two bad breeding seasons in a year, that's your whole population gone if they haven't produced any chicks to replace the parents. So that's been one of the real issues with corncrakes.
Short life, Niall. I mean, it must be one of the shortest lives of any birds on the planet.
It's tiny, that's right. Take garden examples. Birds like robins and blackbirds and blue tits in your garden. They reach breeding age just before their first birthday. They're breeding in their second summer on the planet, the year after they hatched. It's the same with corncrakes. But even though in your garden, birds like robins and blue tits, they have short lives, on average, the corncrake is actually even shorter. We know that land-based birds, on average, have much shorter lifespans than seabirds do. So you're looking at birds like fulmars, a seabird related to the albatross that you get breeding around the Irish coast. They live and breed well into their 80s. They could even be in their 100s. It's hard to know. So those seabirds, birds like Manx shearwaters, easily make it to the age of 50 or 60. A bird like a robin or a wren in a garden, if it makes it to 2 or 3, it's doing pretty well.
It's a good news story all the same.
Oh, very much so. Very much so.
Yeah, and unfortunately not all the stories that we will have up on the Nature News will be good news stories because, we have to report everything. And one of the ones that I've noticed this year, a lot of people talking about, are the butterfly numbers. Where have all our butterflies gone? I saw a quote by Dr. Liam Lycett. He's the chief executive of the National Biodiversity Data Centre. And he said that since 2008, the green-veined butterfly, the most common butterfly in Ireland, has declined by 83%. And it's not just Liam. I was also talking to Jesmond Harding. I suppose some people would refer to him as Mr. Butterfly in Ireland. He's the author of the Irish Butterfly book. Well, he told me that butterfly numbers have crashed on his transect walk in Lullymore in County Kildare. He gave me one example from August of this year, and he compared it to August of last year. On his transect walk last year in August in 2023, he counted 269 butterflies. And this year, the same week, the same walk, the number was 12. So, like, that is a huge number. Now, I've noticed it myself in my own back garden because I have a buddleia bush, the butterfly bush. And last year, we had loads and loads of butterflies last year. Maybe it was a particularly good summer. And one butterfly we had in the garden that I'd never, ever seen in my garden before was the comma. This year, I have not seen a single butterfly on that bush in the garden. So, hopefully, it might be just a yearly thing. I think it might be down to the weather. That's my personal feeling. I think it might be down to the rain that we've had this year. And over the last 12 months or so, we've had quite a lot of rain. And hopefully maybe next year things might improve.
Richard, your garden is quite a mess. You must have lots of butterflies.
Yes, it is a mess. That's to say, it is a wilderness area, which
yeah, exactly.
It should be. None of that potty trains or suburban garden for me. And I have Buddleia bush, and it always has lots of butterflies. This year's a few whites. Green veined, certainly, and probably large whites as well. It's hard to tell. But they're the only ones that are showing up now. Now, this is probably a temporary lull, I suppose, in the butterfly world. I was thinking generally about all of this sort of thing you were mentioning there about corncrakes coming back, and it depended on the vegetation. Now, come back, nettles, all is forgiven. I wanted to ask Niall about this. I believe, I never thought I'd hear this, but people are recommending that nettles be planted. Nettles are usually banished. Now, it seems that planting nettles helps the corncrake. Is that true, Niall?
It absolutely is, Richard. Yes, that's a very important conservation tool, the planting of nettles. Nettles support all sorts of invertebrates, including many butterflies. So it links very nicely to the conversation around the butterflies, because we talk a lot about Buddleia bushes and how they provide nectar for certain species of butterfly. And that's great. And more of us should do that. But what we need to remember, even more important for our butterflies and for our moths, which are often overlooked, the real limiting factor there, it's the food plant that the caterpillars feed on. And nettle is an important food plant for several species of butterfly and moth. And of course, those caterpillars in turn are food for species like corncrakes and blue tits and all sorts of other birds. But more importantly even than that for the corncrake, they provide wonderful cover and wonderful safety from predators. If you're an animal like a fox with a sensitive nose, you're not likely to go headfirst into a nettle patch because it's going to hurt. Corncrakes, with their feathers, they protect them from these stings. They can be right in the middle of the nettles and it gives them an added level of protection. Those areas, those rank parts of the farmland, are slightly wet areas where you get the nettles, you might get yellow flag iris, plants like that springing up. That's often a very good indication of good corncrake habitat. And also, as somebody who's a big fan of nettle soup each year, I love to see nettles growing too. They're a wonderful plant, have a great many uses. I think as children we're always taught to think of them as being bad or dangerous or something to be avoided or to be got rid of, whereas in fact they are a wonderful species for a whole different suite of flora and fauna.
Yes, well then, shouldn't we do a similar thing with other declining species, such as in this case, the butterflies? If we planted more wild crucifers, brassicas, or whatever, would we hope to encourage them back if we pamper them a bit? Would it work?
I think that would be a very important thing to do. I think, especially when we're combating things like pollution, climate change especially, that's having an effect on our butterflies with the more unsettled weather patterns. We're seeing changes in their butterfly composition in Ireland too. Terry, you mentioned earlier the comma, which is a relatively recent colonist to Ireland. The food plant for their young is actually the bramble bush, the blackberry bush. There's an abundance of that around Ireland. Coupled with climate change, it's a warm weather loving butterfly, it may stand to do very well over the coming years. The numbers do seem to be increasing generally of that species. But I think that, often when people are looking at Buddleia bushes in their gardens or looking at the roadsides, they're seeing almost the greatest hits of butterflies. There's so many other scarce species that get overlooked. Even quite common ones like the speckled wood, the meadow brown, some of our most abundant butterflies, but they tend not to be in people's gardens. You have very localised ones then, like the brown hair streak, only found in parts of the Burn and that area around Clare and Galway. Species like the small blue, our smallest butterfly, which isn't blue despite the name, they tend to be found in sand dune systems, very, very localised because they're very specific plants that they're looking for. And I think if we just focus on sort of the main colourful butterflies, then we're actually overlooking the smaller, perhaps more insignificant looking ones that from an ecological point of view are actually really vital.
Our final story today is on the effect of cocaine on sharks. Now, this has nothing to do with Ireland. No need be worried about it. It has to do with a story I came up with that occurred around Florida. And it seems that cocaine is having an effect on these sharks, not just humans, but on the sharks. And it's long been suggested that sea life could be impacted by illegal drugs that are dumped at sea. Now, we know that smugglers sometimes when they're at sea and they're about to be captured, what do? They dump the drugs overboard. And if they're dumped overboard, shark comes along, shark takes this cocaine, ingests it. And what effect is it having? Well, scientists at the Oswaldo Cruz Institute in Brazil, they were curious to know, was it having an effect on the sharks? So what they did is they bought 13 juvenile sharp-nosed sharks from local fishermen, because people eat these particular sharks. They took them back to the lab, they dissected them, and they found that all 13 of these sharks had really high concentrations of cocaine in their liver and in their muscle, as high as other chemicals.
Well, that must be getting into the human food chain well, that's it exactly,
and that's what the worry is. So we'll see how that story pans out.
Yeah, it just shows how interconnected all things are, really, and how we really abuse our marine ecosystem. Obviously, this is illegal behaviour to begin with, people dumping these illegal, highly toxic drugs. They could have all sorts of effects on wildlife. It is quite worrying. And I think there's more and more focus, as you say there, Terry, on effects on the human food chain in particular, what sort of knock-on effects these are having on us. Mm. So, yeah, definitely, you know, a story that I guess in many papers around the world might be seen as a humorous thing or something just played for laughs. But in fact, it's a really very serious story.
Well, when you see when the concentration is as high as caffeine, you know, you'd expect to find caffeine in seawater. And you remember these pollutants too, when they get into organisms, as they pass through food chains, they accumulate. And then if we're at the top of a food chain, well, then it's going to have an effect on us.
You know, we are the sharks are being slaughtered. A million sharks are slaughtered every year. For what? For their fins. For a shark fin soup. Now, there's an irony here. If cocaine gets into the shark tissues, will it show up in shark fin soup? Could this be used to discourage people from eating this dreary old substance called shark fin soup? What do you think?
Well, you know, I think that so much of that that trade in shark fins is illegal. Some is legal. It depends on where you are in the world. It's something that personally I would avoid. I think it's something that you know, it's not sustainable any longer from the point of view of sharks, these apex predators in the oceans. You know, perhaps if people get the message through that they'd be affected by these chemicals in their diet, it may make people think twice. Having said that, we already know that many large predatory fish in the ocean, including sharks, especially things like tuna as well, they can often be repositories for heavy metals like mercury and so on. And that doesn't seem to have dissuaded too many people from eating them so far, even though those metals can have a terrible effect on human health as well. So it might take more than just that story to dissuade people, unfortunately, when it's so culturally ingrained.
Well, you can read Terry's Nature News from home and abroad by visiting our website each week, rte.ie/Mooney. Terry, thank you very much indeed.
You're welcome.
Now, a near-threatened orchid was discovered recently in Oranmore in County Galway for the first time in 80 years. A joint environmental initiative by Galway County Council and Conservation Volunteers Galway to attract pollinating insects to Rinville Park led to the discovery of between 20 and 30 autumn ladies tresses orchids, which are classed as near threatened in the Red Data List of Vascular Plants 2016. Rosina Joyce, Biodiversity Officer for Galway County Council, said the no-mow area at Rinville Park has been a huge success in terms of conservation and biodiversity. Well, we just had to find out more. So, Aidan Ilana spoke with Rosina Joyce.
Hello, Rosina. It's great to talk to you. How are you doing over there in Galway?
Hello, Ina. I'm doing very well and thanks for having me on the programme.
Now, I believe that you are coming to report the success of what we have been always campaigning for, no mow areas and meadows, because having left a part of a park in Oranmore in Galway unmowed this year, you and your companions discovered a rare species of orchid that hadn't been reported for that part of Oranmore for 80 years. And this is a very rare orchid in Ireland. Tell me more. This is most exciting.
Well, Aina, indeed it is very, very exciting. And we're delighted to report that we have found autumn ladies' tresses in the public park in Renville Park in Oranmore. So this plant was actually spotted by a local amateur botanist, Mark O'Mahony, who was out looking for orchids and brought his family up to the park and couldn't believe his luck when he came across the autumn ladies' dresses, and he reported it to the Conservation Volunteers Galway, who have been working with the Galway County Council in managing the site. So there's some great volunteers there, Peter Butler, Ray Fallon and Dan Clavey and all the gang who have been minding and looking after this patch of ground for us and keeping it litter free and have nice signs up just to alert people that we're trying to mind this patch of ground. So what we've seen, once we stop cutting, it allows the flowers, the native flowers, to grow and to flower and to set seed. So now we're getting a chance to see what's coming up naturally there in the ground. Now, this particular site, Aina, is right beside the sea. It's right beside the footpath as you're walking up through the park. So it's very, very accessible. So it's great that people can get up close and see these wildflowers, this wonderful array of wildflowers. And it was already doing very well before we even spotted this orchid. We'd had other orchids coming up and we had plenty of bee orchids and real treasures of flowers, wildflowers. But I can't tell you how excited we were to see the autumn ladies' tresses come up, because it is not a common flower by any, like, by any description. And it's really only found along the coastal parts of Ireland and very few inland sites. So a real treasure to find. And what a reward in our first year of having this area as a no-mo.
Absolutely. I'm just looking at the plant atlas, the most recent plant atlas from the Botanical Society of Britain and Ireland, and looking at the distribution of this particular orchid. And it seems to have a stronghold here in Galway, around Galway Bay and out around Dogs Bay and Connemara, and a bit on the south coast as well, because it's actually a plant of dune grassland and macaire, calcareous grasslands beside the sea, where the grasses are low and there isn't huge amounts of competition from real rich grasses coming out of very fertile soils. And it's unmistakable. This orchid is about 20 centimetres when it's grown, and it has beautiful white flowers that are all in a spiral around it. It comes out in autumn time, hence the autumn ladies' dresses. The summer one we don't have in these parts at all, neither here nor in Britain, so we don't have to worry about a misidentification. And to get something that was last reported from Galway, from Renville, from where you were, 80 years ago, it just shows how long the seeds of these things remain in the soil, just waiting for the right management strategies to allow them grow again. So it's great that this no-mo summer is giving such tangible results, because it'll encourage more people to do it.
Exactly. It will inspire the public to take action like this, and also like the local authority and other people that are managing land, just to give that little bit of space for nature, just to give it a chance. Because what this shows is that if we make that space, if we give it the opportunity to recover, it can, you know. And that's such a positive message. And I know that's something that the Mooney Show, like, really put out there, is that, you know, if we do take these efforts, we can make a difference. So, like, I feel really excited that that message is now getting out there, that this is a really, really good example. And like, your description of the plant there is spot on. I would say it's really hard to spot it. You know, even when I've been up and down to the park now a bit since the recording has come in, and I'm like, I know it's there, and I have to look and look. And then when you relax and you just say, it is there, and then you just wait, and then you start to see one, and then you'll see others. So if people are going up to the park, just give it a, don't give up, it's there. Just look carefully and wait. And that's, you know, even for our own sake and our own well-being, it's good just to slow down, relax, and that connection with nature, it's good for us as well. So having these areas of wildlife and protected for nature in our parks, it's not just good for biodiversity, it's also good for our health and well-being. And even up in the park during the weekend, people were coming out to look at this. So it's great to see this excitement and enthusiasm for botany, for our plants, for our nature. People, families coming up looking for this flower. So, oh, a real good news story, Aina.
Yes, it's a great one to celebrate. But one of our habitats, or one of our ecosystems that is really under threat, are grasslands, because we have so much intensive grasslands. We have so much grasslands for cut for silage, cut for hay, where the chance of flowers developing is very little. So to get these calcareous grasslands, these small, slow-growing grassy areas that are not mown, because flowers like this don't like getting their heads cut off. Grass gets its head cut off because it grows from the bottom, and things like daisies and dandelions grow from the bottom. But all the other flowering plants don't grow from the bottom, and if they get their heads cut off by the mowing machine, well, then there are no flowers, no seeds, and no continuation of that whole ecosystem for the invertebrates that are involved with that. But the actual seed bank in the soil, it's amazing how long this will last when the environmental conditions are changed. If you think in a woodland, if a tree falls down and there's a bit of light, stuff will come up because of the light that wasn't there for maybe 20, 30, 40 years when the place was in shade, but the seeds were still there. And in your area over there where you have this dune grassland or this macaire grassland or this seaside grassland, all of these different species of plants are in the soil because that type of grassland is probably our richest grassland. And when we talk about inland sites, it's not so much the actual seed that is the requirement, it's the calcareous sand. So esker ridges along areas along the Midlands where rivers ran under the ice in the Ice Age and sorted out and stratified the soil levels are areas of sand. A lot of these, of course, quarried away for sand and gravel quarries. But where they're left behind, the same conditions occur. So it's the sea is not necessarily a requirement, but those kind of grasslands are more common along the west coast and along the south coast. And indeed, only last year, they found the very first record of that same orchid in County Down on the dunes over there as well. So seek and you shall find. Orchids are a lovely species, but that particular one with the twisted spiral of beautiful white, really white flowers is gorgeous.
It really is gorgeous, Aina. And do you know what else is lovely about this plant? I got right down and got up close to that plant, and the smell of it, oh, it's like heavenly. It's honey and almonds, lovely, lovely special scent, which I suppose is going to be attracting in the bees that are going to be pollinating it. It's pollinated by bumblebees. So this plant, it depends on real special set of circumstances. It needs the pollinator, it needs the bumblebees to pollinate it. And then it needs the fungi in the soil to help the seeds germinate. The seeds are tiny, tiny little dust-like seeds. And maybe this shows why they're able to last in the soil. They require the fungi in the soil to sustain them. And they take a number of years even to go on to flower. So by having this no-mow area now, the flowers are able to set seed, and they're able to then go out and maybe colonise new areas of the park. It's really, really exciting. But it just shows how we need these particular circumstances. Like you said, by the sea, we need the soil to be nutrient poor. So it gives the chance for the orchid to grow. And then the connection with the fungi in the soil, the healthy soil, and then the bumblebees, the pollinators. So it's a sign of a healthy ecosystem when we're seeing these beautiful, beautiful orchids. You know, we only have 31 native species of orchid in Ireland, and they're all treasures. And, do you know, I see it as like a gateway for people to get and to explore and learn more about our biodiversity. These are very accessible plants. They're so beautiful, and they're really rewarding for people to learn about and to understand and to spot and record. And it is really important. It just shows the importance of citizen science by people getting out there and documenting what they see. So I'd really like to say a big thank you to Mark O'Mahony, the amateur botanist that spotted it, and the conservation volunteers, to Ray Fallon and the gang there, because it's because of them and people like them that we're getting to record it and document it and see how our activities like having no mow areas can make a difference.
Well, another good reason to visit Galway is to go and look at the orchids there. I mean, when you think it's actually on the red data list that was made in 2016, it's near threatened species. So like it's, you know, very, very rare around the country. But if more people are seeing it, then maybe its status might be improved somewhat. So to see something as rare as that and to see it in its native habitat is certainly an opportunity not to be missed. They can keep their dolphins in the sea, I think. What do you think? I think flowers are the way to go. Great talking to you, and go out and enjoy your orchid as long as it's there in flower. Thank you so much indeed.
Thanks a million. It was lovely talking to you, and thanks for covering this story. I really appreciate it.
And you can find more details and see a picture of those wonderful orchids on the website rte.ie/Mooney. It just goes to show what you can do if you do nothing. No mo. Everybody should do a little bit of it in their garden, or actually do none of it in their garden. Don't do anything.
If you're looking for an excuse, like it's a perfect excuse.
It's a perfect excuse. Anyway, let's get back to Terry Flanagan now. Terry, what have you got for me? Another report.
Another report, yes. I was down in County Cork, or Mallow to be precise, beautiful part of the country. I went down to meet Rory Henneberry. Rory's a dog trainer, and he set up an organisation called the Canine Wildlife Project. And the idea of this project is to train dogs to go abroad to Africa to assist rangers in combating poaching.
Oh.
In effect, he's training them to become conservation dogs. Well, I caught up with him as he was putting his latest dog, Heidi, through her paces.
Hi. Rory, how are you?
Very well, thank you, Terry. How are you?
I hope I'm not interrupting.
Not in the slightest.
This is Heidi, is it?
This is Heidi.
She is a Belgian Malinois.
A Belgian Malinois, she is. And we're just getting her ready there now for her upcoming adventures.
Well, before we go into the adventures, I was looking at the adventures you were doing with her here as I was walking up to you. I didn't want to disturb you there. You have this course set out here. You're training her to go up, under, below, left, right. Explain what you're doing.
So what I'm trying to do is build up her stability and her ability to take direction under stress and direction under pressure, and to learn to work with her handler as part of a team. Ultimately, it's stabilising her under stress, stabilising her in the movement so she learns to move with me and move with her future handler.
Now, you said future handler. You are training her to send her abroad. Explain what's going to happen.
Yeah, so Heidi's going to travel to Mozambique to assist a ranger and a team of rangers there with the troubles they're having with poaching on the reserve where they work.
And you're training her here to be prepared for that?
Correct. We're going to travel out with her and spend 2 weeks in Africa with the dog and the new handler, training the handler and preparing him for a life with Heidi, yes.
And what's going to happen when she's there?
Initially, it'll be an intense period of training, more so for the handler than the dog, but to teach them both to operate and work as a team. And she is going to be working as a conservation dog, so primarily in the prevention and detection of would-be poachers who are targeting both the wildlife on the property and then the high-target animals on the property, like elephant and leopard and cheetah.
What exactly will she do? What will her day-to-day role be?
Her primary function is to detect people on the property who shouldn't be there, people who might be in the process of gathering intelligence as to where the rhino are or where the elephant are and their movements. And then, furthermore to that, if it needs be, to track them and follow them, say, in order to detain and question them as to their reasoning for being there.
So will she be an attack dog?
No, not an attack dog, no. Her primary function is to act as a detection dog, so she's detecting people and tools on the property who would be there for ill purposes. So people with the intention of poaching and killing on the property, she's there to assist the rangers in making them aware that they're there, and if they become aware that there's people on the property, then to locate them and follow them.
And after she finds them?
Well, usually she's backed up by a team of rangers, so she'd be working with a team of rangers, including government forces, and what they do then is try and bring the suspects under detention and detain them and bring them for questioning.
Now, tell me a little bit about the training here, because we're here in County Cork. We're in this beautiful location. It's a lovely mild day. It's, what, about 20 degrees centigrade. How can you acclimatise Heidi for what she's going to come across in Africa?
First and foremost, she lives and works in the elements here, and while the temperatures don't compare, it's a hardy breed. They're a tough breed, and they adapt to the environment quite efficiently, in that when she lives here in Ireland, she's got a heavy white undercoat, which in a very short period of time will be shed, and she'll change in colour. She'll be a darker mahogany, dark colour, and she'll lose that undercoat, which won't regrow while she's there.
I must say she looks very, very happy and content here. She's not paying any attention to me at all. Is that why, or is that how you've been training her?
Yes, exactly. So she's very secure around people. She's very safe around people. She doesn't see people as a threat, but she's also aloof to strangers. So I don't want her overly interested in people she doesn't know. She's very good in crowds, and she'll walk through crowds of people, and she'll work around people in distraction. But I don't want her overly focused on strangers, overly affectionate with people she doesn't know. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I see joining us here now is Karina. Karina, you're involved in this project as well, and you're the local vet.
Well, I am. I'm local and I'm not local. My clinic is in Kinmare, but I'm down here with Rory about twice a week for training the dogs as well with him.
You belong to an organisation, a charity. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I got to know Rory actually when I got my own German Shepherd's dog off him nearly 4 years ago and started training my own dog with him. And he told me one day about this idea he had about bringing dogs to Africa for supporting anti-poaching units. And it just from there developed into more and more. And then we founded the charity and got charitable status, and it took off from then.
And you already have sent two dogs over to Africa that you've trained here.
Yes. So the first one was AK. And the second one was Nico. They both went to Namibia, to different locations, but yeah, both to Namibia.
And how are they doing?
They're doing very well. They're doing great.
Heidi here. When do you hope that Heidi can go?
It depends a bit on the handler as well and how they're set up, but we'll be hoping either in November or at the beginning of the year.
Rory, tell me what will happen when you get to Mozambique then.
We're going to arrive into, I think it's Zambia, and travel 5 hours to the Zambezi River, and then it's going to be a 20-kilometer journey by boat to the reserve where she's going to end up working. And from day one, we start the training. So it's not a massive period of time, but the big job once we get there is to get the handler's skills up to the level where he is comfortable and confident in handling the dog and operating with the dog, and leave him with the experience and the capabilities to advance her training and bring her training on. But it's an intense couple of weeks trying to get the handler and the dog acclimatized and working together as an efficient team.
I would have thought, having watched Heidi here with you for the last half hour or hour or so, she is very attached to you. When you get to Mozambique and a new handler is going to take her on, is that not going to confuse the dog somewhat?
It's difficult for the dog, it's difficult for the handler. Once the dog is began the process of bonding, and I will be the biggest distraction to the handler and the dog team when I'm there, because she will look to me for direction when she's under stress. And in that regard, it actually gets a little bit easier for the new handler once I leave, because she will look to bond more strongly with him. And I think it's important to point out that the dog lives with the handler. It sleeps in the house with him. It moves with him, it works with him all day, every day. So it's very much, they become a team. Mm. And while we are upping the skills of the handler while I'm there, and they start building the bond from day one, it's really after I leave that distraction of me being there is gone, and she will look. She's a young dog, and once I'm gone, she will look to make an alliance. She'll look to bond with someone, and she will be getting a lot of praise and attention and affection and living and moving with this handler. So it doesn't take long for that bond to form.
But the bond at the moment is definitely you and her. I've watched you with
sure.
her. And she's not coming near me. She's not going near anyone else. She's watching you all of the time.
Sure.
It's going to be a hard time, that 2 weeks, when you're there in the background and the new trainer is taking her on. And she's looking at him and she's looking at you. And do you worry about that time, that short period of time?
It is intense, and there is a big responsibility on us that we set the dog up to succeed, set the new handler up to succeed, and there's a big responsibility on us to accomplish that goal. So that is our goal for the time there, that we teach him how to deal with distraction, teach him how to deal with stress as a team and as a leader of the dog, and then hopefully that's our goal, to mm-hmm. accomplish that.
Karina, will it be a stressful time for that 2 weeks when they arrive there? The diet will be different, the water will be different, everything will be different.
Well, yeah, there is a lot of changes for the dogs to deal with when they go over. So, of course, we try to keep as many as possible things the same. So we try to bring some of the dry food that she's on here sometimes, you know, with us. And we try to keep a lot of things, as many as possible anyways, the same as here.
And but then yes, gradually wean her
exactly.
off them, I presume.
Yeah, yeah. But it is no doubt stressful for them. But the fact that she has been trained for nearly 2 years now in that style of training. They are used to deal with stress of all different kind of sorts, which makes it then easier for them to adapt there as well.
Do you worry about things like parasites and infection when they get there?
Yes, of course, and not just when they get there, but also then when they live there. So we always kind of inform ourselves in advance, you know, what is particularly dangerous there for them, because it might be completely different to obviously what's a problem here. So, for example, in Mozambique, the tsetse fly is a very big problem for them. So that's kind of things that we try to rule out as many as possible in advance.
I would have thought something as well like snakes. That dog has not seen a snake here.
Yes.
It gets to Mozambique. I'm sure it's going to see plenty of snakes. How will the dog react to something it has never seen before?
There is definitely things, as you said, that we can't train here because they're just not here, like snakes. Like with regards to the snakes, the fact that she'll be all the time actually tracking on lead, definitely the risk will be decreased of her meeting a snake without kind of someone being, you know, there with her and holding her back. If we get across actually snakes or even sometimes spiders or something that is potentially poisonous to her, we try to actually train then in that situation with her so that she'll get an aversion against it. But yes, of course, there are risky situations there for her, like that we try to prepare her as much as possible.
Rory, you told me that you've already sent two dogs over to Africa. Tell me how successful they've been.
It's difficult to measure specific success because their first job is that of a deterrent. So you will see a decrease immediately in the numbers of attempted poaching in the area where they're deployed. In other words, as soon as the dog arrives, the information that the dog is there travels very fast to the people living in and around the area. They call it the bush telegraph, and it's an efficient method of communication. So the dog is a very efficient deterrent to people. And then what it does is it really speeds up the capabilities of the rangers. So whether in the worst case scenario they're arriving at an incident where an animal has been dispatched, it speeds up their ability to track the perpetrators. If it's a case where there's suspects on the property and they've got a report of suspects, they can go to an area and track from that point, and the dog really speeds up that capability. So you end up with more arrests, more apprehensions, and a decrease in the actual attempts in the training just from her presence alone as a preventive measure. You can see an increase in the number of apprehension. You can see an increase in the efficiency of the teams and the speed in which they can apprehend suspects. And in the places where they have been deployed, there has been a decrease in the number of efforts of poaching. But it would be misleading to say for certain that all the credit should go to the presence of the dog.
So it won't be long now before you travel to Mozambique and you leave her there. How will you feel then?
It's an emotional time, absolutely. It's mixed between a sense of missing the dog, and there's always a distinct emotional aspect to it, but also a huge sense of pride that we've managed to contribute in a positive way to what's happening out there, and that the dog is filling its purpose. You know, from day one, this was the goal for the dog, and the fact that she's going to live a life where she's serving a purpose and that she's contributing to the efforts out there, which is in a dire state at the moment. I mean, there's a great sense of pride and a feeling of a sense of accomplishment and duty as well. So, yeah, it's a difficult one.
Do you have any worries whether she'll settle in or not?
No. Like, just from experience and their adaptability, the adaptability of the breed, and having a personal relationship with the handler in advance of going over there, like, it's a very rigorous process we put into the selection of the handler and the specific reserve that the dogs go to, in the sense of we want to know that they have the best interest of the dog at heart, that they value her not only as an asset but also as part of the team and a family member ultimately. And in that sense, we know that the dog is being very well cared for in every way. And it certainly makes it easier and puts us at ease leaving the dog there.
The training is very intense. It must be very expensive to get a dog ready to go to Africa.
It is. You'll be talking probably up to €20,000 to get a dog over. Now, that doesn't include any of us getting paid for it. That's just really the costs of the handler, one or two handlers going over, the dog going over and all the blood tests, everything that needs to be done. And of course, bringing the dog up for 2 years, you know, food, vaccinations, all that.
Where do you see the future then? Will you continue this work, continue training dogs here, continue sending them out to Africa?
Yeah, absolutely. If we can, we will. We will do everything we can to continue with it, because we've put a lot of effort into it. We can see the changes there as well, and we see the appreciation of the new handlers when they get the dogs and what a difference it makes to them.
Fascinating story, Terry. Did you get some pictures?
Of course I did. Some beautiful pictures, and we'll have them up on the website.
Thank you very much indeed, Terry. Thanks also to Aidan Ilana, Richard Collins and Niall Hatch. That's all we have time for. Visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/media. Till next week, goodbye, goodbye, goodbye.